Hello, folks. Welcome to the premium edition of the Labor Relations Information Systems podcast series. My name is Will Aitchison, and today we're going to delve into a problem that is increasingly bedeviling employers. As you know, we've had a fairly conservative administration in Washington, D.C., and the majority of judges who are currently sitting in the federal courts are politically conservative by nature, which means their decisions tend, in an employment context, to favor employers rather than labor unions or employees. Against that backdrop, a number of state legislatures and local city councils and county boards of supervisors have decided to take matters into their own hands, and they have passed a series of employment laws around the country that are more generous than the standard alphabet soup of employment laws we see at the federal level. They provide, for example, a higher minimum wage than is provided by the Fair Labor Standards Act, more family leave, greater protection for disabilities than the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so on and so forth. How is an employer to navigate this increasingly complicated landscape of federal, state, and local laws, all dealing with the employment relationship? Our guest today is going to help us unravel that situation. I'm thrilled to have on the podcast April Upchurch Fredrickson. She is an attorney in the Jackson Lewis law firm. April will describe a bit about what Jackson Lewis is, but it's one of the largest employer side law firms in the country. April is a graduate of the University of Oregon. Go Ducks. And she went to Northeastern University Law School in Boston, Massachusetts. Since then, she's been both in the Bay Area and now in the Portland area, practicing law, advising employers in different employment and labor relations issues. What got me interested in interviewing April is she is one of many attorneys in the Jackson Lewis firm who posts on the firm's blog. And she had a wonderful post on the new family leave law in Oregon. Oregon now has, as she will describe, in many particulars, the most generous family leave law in the country. And April and I are going to use the focus of Oregon's family leave law to talk about the bigger issue, and that is this panoply of different federal, state, and local employment laws that all bear upon the employer-employee or employer-union relationship. And how does an employer comply with one of those laws without potentially getting into trouble with another of those laws? So, with no further ado, I give you April Upchurch Fredrickson. April, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I am excited to be here.
Great. First of all, tell us a little bit about your firm, Jackson Lewis, and how the firm has developed over the last few years to be becoming one of the, two or three major players in employment side labor law in the country.
Yeah, so Jackson Lewis is a nationwide law firm. We are up to over 900 employment lawyers now. So the benefit of being part of Jackson Lewis and working with Jackson Lewis is really there is a lawyer who knows everything there is to know about employment law. So you never have to go find someone or research a particular area of the law because we have people who already know it. And so it's a great law firm. We have offices in 38 states, and we have, I think we're up to close to 60 offices now as well. So we are a major player, and we do only workplace law on behalf of management.
So, for example, if you've got a problem you've never encountered before, whatever that might be, it could be there's a lawyer waiting in an office in Nashville, Tennessee, who could have that office, and you have the ability to reach out to them.
That is exactly the case. It's very rare that I'm starting from scratch because we have subject matter experts in everything. And pay equity is a really good example. We have an entire office devoted to doing statistical analysis for pay equity. So if we ever have a client with a pay equity question who wants to take a look at their comp system, we just pick up the phone and we call Denver. We say, okay, here you go.
That's great. Now, one of the challenges Jackson Lewis would have, I would imagine, is that with offices in all of these various states, Jackson Lewis has a compliance role for its clients. Its clients turn to the firm and say, hey, what do we need to do to comply with, for example, the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Family and Medical Leave Act? That requires you in every state you're in to learn whatever the state and local laws are that may supplement or even expand upon federal laws. Is that right?
That is correct. We do many things for our clients. One of the things that we do is we try and keep them out of trouble. So in doing that, we advise them how to comply with the law so that they can avoid being sued. And that does require us to have a really good handle on state and also federal law.
And the changes at the state law level, particularly in the last 5 years, it seems like it's one after another after another.
Yeah, that is absolutely true, especially these last two sessions. We've gotten two major pieces of employment legislation, both of these last two sessions. So we are seeing a ton of new legislation.
Right. When I just look up and down the West Coast, for example, California has this hugely complicated and rich labor code, they call it, and the latest addition to which, well, not the latest, but the most significant addition to which lately is the kin care law. Then you come up into Washington, and Washington has its own family leave and sick leave law. But for our purposes today, let's talk about Oregon, because Oregon has moved, as you and I both know, or will move in a couple of weeks, to the most expansive family leave law in the country. And that's just one of many individual Oregon laws that supplement the federal statutes. Let's take a step back and start from the beginning. Looking at Oregon as an example, but understanding for our listeners, we're just using it as an example. This may be going on in your state out there. In fact, likely is going on in your state out there. And you definitely need to consult with local counsel to make sure you understand what those laws are. But looking at Oregon as an example, let's start with the basics. Discrimination law often stems from what judges like to call protected classes, people who are protected by the law. Does Oregon, or do some of the cities and counties in Oregon, have a broader list of protected classes than we see in federal government?
It sure does. Some of the additions in the Oregon law, and I think one of the most important, is sexual orientation. That's not something that you see in the federal law, but it's something we've had here in Oregon for several years. Sexual orientation also includes gender identity and gender dysphoria. So transgender individual would have protections under Oregon state law that they don't under federal law. The other really interesting difference about Oregon's protected class is age. Under federal law, age is protected under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act at age 40. In Oregon, it's age 18. Which is kind of curious, because that isn't necessarily a group that I would see, you know, or would have thought was being discriminated against. But, you know, you often hear comments about millennials these days. You know, lots of people like to make fun of millennials. Well, in Oregon, that's an issue, because at 18, you're protected. So you can't discriminate against someone because they are too young in Oregon, which again is an interesting difference. And then Oregon also protects marital status, and then we also protect injured workers. That's under a different statute, but Oregon still considers that as one of its protected classes. So if you filed a workers' compensation claim, your employer can't discriminate against you based on that.
And we get down to the local jurisdiction level in Oregon, and the list goes on and on. Portland, for example, prohibits discrimination against someone based on the source of their income, something I don't really understand. Are there others like that?
There are, and Portland actually just implemented a new one, and it's atheism or being agnostic. So no longer can they discriminate against you because you are an atheist.
Wait a minute. We both live in Portland. I thought everybody here was atheist or agnostic. Is there really a discrimination problem?
Well, exactly. That's the point. So I didn't ever realize that was an issue, but apparently the city council thinks it is. So now there is an official protection for that.
All right. Let's talk about some of the laws at the state level now. And what drew me to you resulted in me inviting you on this podcast. Thank you, by the way, for joining us.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. What drew me to you was a blog post. Jackson Lewis has a number of blogs that you have. They're accessible by anybody. And this, I don't think, was a secret, but people like me who normally are on the other side of the table from you read those blogs. I have for many years touted them to our clients as being a wonderful source of current information about what the law is. You had a blog post about Oregon's new pregnancy accommodation statute. Tell us about this and what it does to amp up protections under federal law for pregnancy.
Sure. So effective January 1, 2020, there is a new state law in Oregon that requires employers to accommodate medical conditions related to pregnancy, including childbirth and lactation. And how that's different from federal law is that under federal law, if your pregnancy constituted a disability, then you may be entitled to accommodation under that particular statute. But there's a whole host of pregnancy-related conditions that don't rise to the level of a disability.
Such as?
For example, maybe you just need more bathroom breaks.
Okay.
Very common during pregnancy. Maybe you're nauseous in the morning and you need additional time to have a quick bite so that your stomach will settle down. Again, very common for women who are pregnant.
Maybe your husband can do nothing right anymore.
Maybe.
Okay.
But anyway, so essentially this really gives employers the obligation to accommodate those types of conditions, as to where before it might not have risen to the level of a disability and there was no official requirement to accommodate. And the same thing with lactation. So for example, maybe you need to pump breast milk every 2 hours. And so the employer would now have to accommodate that, as long as it doesn't constitute an undue hardship, which is significant expense or inability to do it.
A question for you. Several years ago, the Fair Labor Standards Act was amended to include a modest treatment of lactation issues. Does the Oregon law expand upon those protections?
It really doesn't say. I mean, it's a different analysis because under the FLSA, you need to provide a private place and additional breaks, reasonable breaks. The pregnancy accommodation statute doesn't really tell you what you have to do, except that it tells you you have to do it unless it's an undue hardship. So it doesn't necessarily expand in the language of the statute. But it might, because, you know, under the FLSA, an employer could argue that the breaks you're seeking are unreasonable. Under the state statute, if it doesn't constitute an undue hardship, they've got to do it.
Right. And I can imagine that under the state statute, the broader terms of the state statute, there could be accommodations other than simply breaks that someone might need.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, let's turn to what I think was one of the biggest ones when it went through the legislature here, paid sick leave.
Yes.
We have paid sick leave in Oregon, don't we?
We do. And I feel like everything in Oregon comes from the city of Seattle. City of Seattle does it first, and then it migrates to Oregon.
That's certainly where we got our homeless problem, I think.
Unfortunately.
Hey, I'm sorry to people in Seattle, but there is this longstanding Portland-Seattle rivalry.
Yes.
Okay.
And I will say I'm a Timbers fan.
Oh, there
we go. So we have to throw that in there.
Portland Timbers. Okay. Continue. I interrupted you.
Anyway, so we do have paid sick leave, and under Oregon's paid sick leave statute, employees will accrue 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours of work Employers can cap it at 40 hours annually, and then there is also a carryover limit for 40 hours, unless you're going to front load. If you front load, then that carryover limit doesn't necessarily apply. But overall accrual will be capped at 80 hours.
Most of our listeners operate in a public sector environment where there are collective bargaining agreements that are in place. And those collective bargaining agreements virtually always have paid sick leave in them. So this is just a reminder. Unless you have a law like Oregon's for paid sick leave, and unless you have a collective bargaining agreement, or unless you have a fairly generous employer practice out there, there's no obligation under the law for the employer to give you paid sick leave. So the Oregon statute was a big deal, wasn't it?
Right. It was a big deal. And there's kind of a trend. You know, we see laws move in trends. And paid sick leave was a trend, I would say, about 3 years ago. And a lot of states were now are getting into paid sick leave. And, you know, when I first started practicing, the rule was, well, of course, there's no requirement for paid sick leave. There's no requirement for paid vacation. It's up to your employer. And that's not the case anymore.
Is there a funding mechanism for the paid sick leave law? Or is it just flatly an employer obligation?
It's an employer obligation.
Okay. Now, let's turn to the subject of yesterday's USA Today article that is captioned, Oregon could soon have nation's most progressive paid family leave laws. What is USA talking about? USA Today talking about?
Well, so this session,
I do it too.
Mike is confusing me. So now we have a paid sick leave law in Oregon. It doesn't go into effect for a couple of years, so employers have time to figure it out. It's basically a tax. So employers will pay a portion of the tax to fund it, as will employees. And under the new law, employees will have 12 weeks of paid sick leave. It's funded by the state.
Paid sick leave?
Oh, I'm sorry. Paid family leave.
Okay.
Family and medical leave. So eligible employees, all they have to do is essentially earn $1,000 during the base year for the law. And if they do that, then they're eligible for 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. And there are, again, employer contributions and employee contributions as well.
So lots of questions about this that I assume your clients have as well. Question number one, we've got a collective bargaining agreement out there that already says paid sick leave and paid vacation time. Can we force employees to use that time that they must draw down on that when they have a condition that qualifies under the Oregon family leave law?
So you cannot. Employees get to use their paid sick and paid vacation time like they want, and then they have an additional right to this other 12 weeks. They can use it, though, if they want to supplement the amount that they're receiving from the state, because the state is not paying them 100%, in most cases, they're not paying them 100% of their actual wage. So it's not a full replacement wage. So if they want to supplement with paid time off, they can do that, but the employer can't require them to use that.
What's the formula for the rate at which employees are paid? Do you know?
I don't know what the formula is. At this point, it may be in the statute, but it also may be something that they're waiting for regulations, because BOLI is going to have to actually draft administrative regulations to implement the law.
Amber just used an acronym that is very common in Oregon, but nobody outside of Oregon is going to know what it means. What's BOLI?
The Bureau of Labor and Industries, and that's our state administrative agency that is responsible for all of our labor laws.
All right. So employees are entitled to 12 weeks of paid family leave. Let's talk. Next question is about eligibility. Is the eligibility for this type of family leave any different than the eligibility that we see under the Family and Medical Leave Act? So serious health condition and or pregnancy, or not pregnancy, but childbirth, child care, adoption, military, exigency leave. Is it different in, under Oregon law than under the FMLA?
So the eligibility is different in that the only requirement is that the employee make a certain amount of money during the base year. It works similar to unemployment benefits where you have to actually earn a certain amount of money during the base year in order to receive the benefits. So that's really the only eligibility criteria in the statute. It's very different from the FMLA because under the FMLA, you have to be employed for 12 months and work 1,250 hours before you get time off. There doesn't seem to be any similar criteria in the new law. So before, you only get the time off, you know, kind of if you've earned it, you've been there long enough to get it. Here, you just have to make $1,000.
And then you're there. What about the conditions covered by the law, the state law? Are they different than the FMLA?
They're very similar. So the new law covers serious health condition leave for yourself or a family member, baby bonding leave, and then also safe leave, which is leave taken for domestic violence or sexual assault or to deal with those types of things.
Yeah, and that's those are a little bit broader than we would see under the FMLA.
Yes.
Let's also talk about the integration of this leave with a collective bargaining agreement. We've talked about one aspect of it. What if an employer has benefits, family leave benefits, in a collective bargaining agreement that are more generous than those provided under Oregon law? Can it simply say, okay, now all I have to do is comply with the Oregon statute?
It cannot. So if you have benefits that are more generous in your collective bargaining agreement, you're stuck with those benefits. If you have no benefits in your collective bargaining agreement, then you have to comply with the law because there is a provision that suggests, you know, these are the minimum benefits. So they're not trying to take anything away from people with more generous benefits, but you don't get a complete pass just because you have a collective bargaining agreement.
A phrase I've used in our seminars over the years in trying to describe this proposition has been an employer has an obligation to comply with the greatest grant of rights to employees. Wherever that may be, it may be in federal law, maybe in a collective bargaining agreement, maybe in a local ordinance, maybe in a state statute. Is that phrase correct?
It is.
Okay, good. Otherwise, I'd have to apologize to a lot of people. Let's move on to the Workplace Fairness Act. Those are words we don't see in federal law.
Yeah.
What is it?
So this is one of the major pieces of legislation that we got from this session. And it really, again, it kind of follows something similar that Washington did. And it really is to address some of the concerns that we saw in the Me Too movement. It is a discrimination-based statute. It prevents non-disclosure provisions, non-disparagement provisions as a condition of employment or continued employment if it prevents someone from talking about discrimination. Usually we see those kind of provisions in settlement agreements. I have never seen an employer who starts off the employment relationship and says, by the way, if you're harassed here, you can't talk about it.
Yeah,
that's very rare.
I haven't seen that either.
Right.
That seems to me like a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah, exactly. But so the Oregon law prevents those types of agreements if there's any discrimination at all, as opposed to where Washington, it's related to sex harassment and sex discrimination. So Oregon has broadened it and essentially says you can't have those provisions if the effect is to prevent people from talking about discrimination and harassment. So that's one piece of the law. The second piece addresses the settlement agreements that we just mentioned. You can no longer have a settlement agreement with a non-disclosure, non-disparagement, no rehire provision unless the employee asks for it. So the employee has to ask for that type of a provision. Otherwise, you're engaging in an unfair employment practice by putting a provision like that in the settlement agreement.
Is that without regard to whether or not the topic covered by the non-disclosure agreement is sexual harassment or anything? Is it just simply a broad non-disclosure agreement?
It's any type of employment discrimination. So if the subject of the litigation is employment discrimination, then really you can't have those kinds of provisions if it prevents the person from talking about what happened to them.
Well, what are the remedies?
There is a private right of action, and then you can also file a BOLI claim.
Are there any prescribed statutory penalties, or is this just going to be up to a jury, for example?
At this point, there are no statutory penalties, but again, this is a brand new law from this legislative session, and so again, BOLI will likely promulgate regulations, and so we'll have to see what those regulations look like. But there are even more parts to the statute.
Oh. Do tell.
So the biggest issue, and this is just insane to me, but so our current statute of limitations for discrimination claims in Oregon is 1 year. This extends the statute of limitations to 5 years. So now when we defend claims, the conduct is fairly recent. You still have your witnesses. There's still a lot of documents typically because it's within a year. You know, it just happened. Now we're looking at claims possibly going 5 years back for conduct going 5 years back. That's going to be really, really difficult to deal with because a lot of the witnesses aren't going to be in the workplace any longer because people move on. So probably depending on what side of the fence you're on, you know, obviously that's a really good thing for plaintiff's lawyers. It's not a great thing for defense lawyers.
Is that expansion of the statute of limitations retroactive?
So it's the five-year statute of limitations goes into effect 90 days after the legislature ends. So probably about 60 days from now or something like that. But it's for conduct that occurs from when the statute goes into effect forward. I'm not going to get a case tomorrow based on 5 years, something that happened 5 years ago. But 5 years from now,
I
might get a case that is based on something that happened today.
Any other goodies in this?
The last piece is that employers must now have a harassment and discrimination policy. Most employers have them anyway, but this statute requires that certain things be included in the harassment and discrimination policy, and it's going to virtually require every employer to amend their current discrimination policy. So, for example, one of the things that you need to do is you need to provide a complaint procedure. That's fine, and most policies already do that. You need to identify who the person's going to complain to. You need to provide an alternate person for the person to complain to. You also need to tell people about the five-year statute of limitations. You need to tell them that employers can no longer require non-disclosure, non-disparagement agreements as a condition of employment. And you also have to tell them what they can do if they feel that they're aggrieved by this new law. So it's essentially taking this new law, plopping it into a discrimination and harassment policy, and then giving that to your employees, not just putting it in your handbook, giving it to your employees.
One of my pet peeves is when I deal with an employer that has gone to somebody, whoever that somebody is, and purchased a bunch of employment rules and regulations off the shelf, and they're just using them. There's national companies that sell these things, correct?
Yes.
And an employer is just increasingly at risk doing that with this proliferation of state and local employment laws. I'd imagine that'd be a big concern for you folks.
Absolutely. Unless you're working with someone who is really monitoring the state law, and there are some large, you know, kind of HR companies that do that and that are trustworthy and we trust their products. If you are Googling your handbook, that's a problem. And believe it or not, some small employers do that.
Sure.
They just go to Google and they type in sample employee handbook and up pops some product and then they make some changes and then they pass it out. You cannot do that in Oregon.
And it's really cheap to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
At least it's initially cheap until you get sued for
right.
The policy.
Right.
I talked about on this podcast, I want to say about 9 months ago, there's a disciplinary case coming out of the Austin Police Department and it involved a police officer who was suspended for violating the employer's social media policy. The social media policy was purchased off the shelf from a California organization, and the arbitrator, in overturning the discipline, criticized the policy and it said, look, there's not one size fits all here. It has to, these sorts of policies have to be adapted to your local needs.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And particularly with social media policies, because you get into a realm where it's really easy to violate Section 7 of the NLRA. And a lot of employers, or I'm sorry, a lot of employers don't necessarily realize that some of the things that may look neutral in your policy may have an impact on an employee's right to talk about wages, conditions, and working conditions.
You started this, April. And I want to follow that. I want to go down that rabbit hole for just a moment.
Yeah.
How does a social media policy, how does it implicate Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act?
So just to kind of back up, Section 7 allows employees to talk about wages, hours, and working conditions. And so what we have seen in the last few years is employees posting comments about their work conditions on social media. That's not fun for an employer because almost always the comments that they're concerned about are negative. But if the employees are talking about wages, hours, working conditions, employers can't then do anything about that. And so a social media policy needs to ensure that it isn't telling employees that they can't make disparaging remarks about their employer on social media and things along those lines, because otherwise you're going to get in trouble with the board, the NLRB.
Now, most of our listeners, again, are in the public sector. The NLRA doesn't apply to the public sector, but the principles you've just described do exist in various state and local collective bargaining laws around the country. And just a word to the wise, to both employers and labor people who are listening to this, what April has had to say is absolutely right. If you have not looked at your social media policy and updated it any time in the last year or maybe even 6 months, watch out, because this is a rapidly changing topic. Okay, out of the rapid hole.
Okay.
And back to various Oregon laws. Now we have the Pay Equity Act. I can sort of guess what that's about, but tell us.
Yeah, so the Pay Equity Act prevents discrimination in pay based on someone's inclusion in a protected class. So obviously, we can't pay people based on, you know, whether they're in a protected class or not. The previous statute in Oregon just addressed sex. So, you know, it basically said you have to pay men and women comparable wages for comparable work. The pay equity law really expanded that and now essentially makes it so that you can't discriminate on the basis of pay if you're in any of the protected classes. So, you know, the ones that we talked about at the beginning of the hour.
Like race or religion.
Yeah, exactly.
That sort of thing.
Exactly. And so, and then it also kind of put a little bit more meat on the bones as far as what that means. And it essentially means that you have to pay equal pay for comparable work. And comparable work is work that requires substantially similar knowledge, skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions, regardless of the job description or title. So employers, what they should be doing is identifying positions that require comparable work and then looking at the amount of money that people are earning in those positions to make sure that there is no disparities. If there are disparities, it's okay if you can tie it to seniority, a merit system, a change in location, travel, education, training, experience, or a combination of any of those factors. If you can't, and if you happen to have someone who files a pay equity claim who's in a protected class, it's going to be very difficult to show like why the pay was different for that person.
Now, a couple of things. First of all, the FLSA has an equal pay provision. It's called the Equal Pay Act. But that's not as broad as what you're describing, correct?
Correct. This applies to all protected classes.
And the FLSA is just based on sex.
Correct.
Second comment or maybe question to you. We have a Q&A section on our webpage, and people write in questions to us all the time. And of course, we answer with a disclaimer that we're not their lawyers and they shouldn't rely on anything that we say. And I would guess once every month or so, someone will write in and say, hey, look, he's doing the same sort of job that I'm doing, but he's getting more money and I'm not. And our answer always has been, there's nothing in that practice that violates anything in federal law, provided the reason he's getting more money is not because he or you are in a protected class. Are we giving the right advice?
I would say it's a little more nuanced than that now.
Okay, help me out.
And it's tough because the statute is a discrimination statute. Like, that's the purpose. You don't want people making decisions based on someone's protected class. But the way that the statute is set up now is that you basically have to have comparable pay for comparable work unless you can identify one of these other factors. If you can't identify one of those other factors that results in the disparity, then you essentially have a violation if the person isn't in a protected class. So there's no sort of intent required by the statute. You don't have to show that the decision was made because the person's in a protected class, because now it's really a question of why is there a differential if you can't prove that it falls into the statute. You have a problem.
So instead of what judges would call a disparate treatment analysis, you're really in a disparate impact analysis where the same pay practice seems or impacts different protected classes in different ways. And if it does, you'd better have a darn good explanation for that.
Yeah, to some extent, I think that that's right, except it might not be a policy, which is usually what disparate impact, you're usually dealing with a policy. It could be something as simple as, you know, I hired this person 5 years ago at their old job, they were making $50,000. I hired them in at $55,000, which was higher than what I was paying my other folks. So it's not because of the person's protected class. It's not really a policy. It's because they happen to be making more. And you wanted to bring them over, and you're never going to offer someone less than what they make at their current job. So it's a really interesting statute. There is an affirmative defense to a private right of action, at least to the punitive damages piece. And that is if you do a pay equity analysis within a certain amount of time before the complaint is filed, and you look at your pay practices and you fix them, then that is a defense to the punitive damages portion of the statute. So right now we're encouraging all employers to do that analysis, look at their pay practices, figure out if they have an issue. That's again what our Denver folks do, and then fix it before the private right of action takes effect at 2021.
Sounds like business is booming in the pay equity analysis.
It sure is.
Sector.
Yeah, okay. It is.
Now, let me ask you a question about this. Many of these changes, not all of them, but many of them seemed aimed at problems that women are facing in the workplace. And at the same time that we're seeing all of these changes, we are seeing a marked change in the participation of women at the legislative level. We have more women legislators at the federal level. Hasn't quite infected the Senate yet, but in the House of Representatives. And in state legislatures, you see many women represented, many more than you ever would before. In fact, I think in the Oregon House of Representatives, maybe it's not a majority, but it's getting close. Do you tie those two together, the increased presence of women in legislatures and the focus on these types of statutes?
I sure do. Yeah. And that is, I mean, that is what came to mind as I was looking at all of the new legislation to, you know, prepare for today, is that much of what we're seeing is female based. It's being expanded to all protected classes, but I think the real benefit of a lot of the legislation is for women.
Okay. A few more, and I know you've been generous with your time with me so far, but I've just got to ask you a few more of these statutes
Sure.
that we've got in Oregon. First, let me start with a bit of an introduction. I think it was about 13, 12 years ago, the United States Supreme Court issued what has later been termed by federal courts of appeals a revolutionary First Amendment decision, one called Garcetti versus Sabalos. And it analyzed the free speech rights of public sector employees. And in Garcetti, the Supreme Court held that if speech arose out of the employee's job, it was unprotected under the First Amendment.
Hmm.
And since Garcetti, courts have ruled against public employees bringing free speech lawsuits. The last time I did a tally was a few years ago, well over 95% of the time. And all sorts of speech that we once thought might be protected by the First Amendment isn't. And one of those areas is whistleblowing. And whistleblowing broadly defined as an employee's report of illegal activity on the part of the employer or individual employees, other individual employees. So, for example, in law enforcement, there's a subset of cases out there, some of which are from federal court of appeals now, where one police officer has reported the on-duty misconduct of another police officer, has said, for example, that I watched that officer use excessive force. The reporting officer is then fired. The reporting officer is claiming, look, I was fired in retaliation for my speech. And courts have said, under Garcetti, reporting the misconduct of fellow employees is part of the job, and therefore, it's not protected by the First Amendment. And what these sorts of cases have done is to focus employees in the public service to not bring cases under the First Amendment for what I would think of as standard whistleblowing, but instead to look at state statutes on whistleblowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume in Oregon, you're going to help us out on this, that we have a whistleblower statute where that police officer reporting the misconduct of a fellow police officer would potentially be protected under the law.
Yeah. We have ORS 659A199, which is a really broad whistleblower statute, and it essentially prevents an employer from taking any adverse action against an employee who reports information that he believes is evidence of a violation of state, federal, or local law, as long as it's brought in good faith. So the employee, as long as they make an allegation of a potential violation of the law, that employee is protected. It doesn't mean that the employee has to be right. They can be 100% wrong as to whether it's a violation of the law or not, but as long as they in good faith believe that it is, that employee is protected. And it sounds like that's much different than what you're talking about under Garcetti.
Yeah, very much different. Under Garcetti, the reporting officer's statements could be completely true, and it could also be completely true that the other officer's actions were illegal,
mm-hmm.
and there'd be no protection
wow.
under Garcetti.
Wow.
So quite different than under the whistleblower statute.
Yeah.
Just a reminder to everybody, not everything is whistleblowing. Complaining is not whistleblowing. Reporting a violation of the employer's rules is not whistleblowing. Yeah. What is whistleblowing that is protected by these state whistleblowing laws?
So it's actually evidence of a violation of state, federal, or local law. So you have to actually find a law that you believe has been broken. You don't necessarily have to say, I think you violated this particular law and here's the statute. But you do have to say something like, I think that my employer engaged in sexual harassment, for example. A lot of times we see these whistleblowing claims as kind of tag along claims. So the underlying claim might be a sex harassment claim. But then they'll say they were retaliated against for raising sex harassment, which is a violation of the law. And so then you'll get the 199 claim in addition to the retaliation claim under the 030, the sex harassment statute.
And with whistleblowing in Oregon, is there a private right of action? Can employees bring a lawsuit under this statute?
Yes, there is a private right of action. You can go straight to court if you would like, or you can also file a claim with BOLI.
And damages? Can you get punitive damages?
You can get punitive damages in Oregon, yes.
All right. Now, Oregon has a ban the box statute. And I'll confess, when I first heard that phrase, ban the box, without knowing what it was, I thought it dealt with, you know, amending your zoning laws so Walmart couldn't come into town. I've been educated since, but educate all of our listeners. What are ban the box statutes?
Sure. So a ban the box statute is essentially a statute that prevents an employer from asking about criminal convictions before the interview stage of hiring. And the purpose is so that employers are not automatically screening out people with criminal convictions. And the reason they call it ban the box is because a lot of times employers had that question on their application, and you know, you'd have to check the box as to whether you have been convicted of a crime or not. So you can no longer do that in Oregon.
And that is related to, or sort of in the same ballpark as, an Oregon statute dealing with credit checks. Tell us about that.
Yep. So Oregon also has a statute that prevents employers from obtaining or using credit checks or credit history information unless there is a legitimate business reason for doing it.
Do both of these statutes, ban the box and credit check, do they have exceptions for public employers or certain types of public employees, like police officers?
They do. And you know, I didn't bring that with me, so I can't actually go over them. But they do definitely have exceptions for people who, for example, who might be dealing with vulnerable populations. And so, for example, you might be able to ask someone, like in a police officer role, have you been convicted of a crime? That makes complete sense. So Right. There are exceptions.
All right. We have a law that requires mandatory rest breaks and meal breaks in Oregon. First of all, you know a lot about the FLSA. Are there any mandatory rest breaks and meal breaks under the FLSA at the federal level?
There are not. I mean, that's something that is really reserved for states because it deals with health and safety of workers. And so that's where we get the meal and rest break provisions, is that it's not necessarily a pay thing, but it's to preserve the health and safety of workers.
And about the only way the FLSA deals with breaks and meal periods is to say, breaks are generally work time under the FLSA. There's time thresholds you have to meet.
Right.
And meal periods, if the employee is completely relieved of duty, are not work time under the FLSA. But that's about all the FLSA says.
Yeah.
In Oregon, you got to give them, right? You got to give these breaks.
You do. There are some exceptions for meal periods, but you must give people, it's 2 10-minute breaks, one for every 4 hours or a major portion thereof. And then the meal period is, if you work 6 hours or more, you must give someone a 30-minute unpaid meal period.
Unpaid meal period, not paid.
Correct, unpaid.
All right. Well, that'll be the next legislative session.
Oh, my gosh.
I predict. I want to wind this up talking a little bit about overtime, since we're talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act. Most of the folks listening to this podcast are in one way or another involved in the public safety world. They're law enforcement officers, firefighters, corrections officers, EMTs, and people who are involved in the HR or union business associated with those various provisions. And under federal law, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a section called Section 7K, if you are a law enforcement officer, you're not entitled to overtime until you work more than 43 hours in a 7-day work period. And you can have work periods, if you're an employer, up to 28 days in length. And the overtime threshold for the 28-day work period is 171 hours. So you don't get overtime until if at the end of 171 hours you've worked, at the end of 28 days you've worked 171 hours. And firefighters have longer thresholds. Firefighters are roughly the average of a 53-hour week before they get overtime. And those provisions in the FLSA actually have been written into Oregon's wage and hour laws, so they're very comparable. But Oregon's wage and hour laws for other employees, employees who aren't covered by these exemptions, are considerably more generous than that, aren't they? Mm-hmm. What do they require?
So if you don't fall under one of those exemptions and you're just a regular hourly employee, then it is essentially time and a half if you work more than 40 hours in a designated work week.
And is there any overtime called for under Oregon law if you work a long work day?
There is not.
Okay. No. So you just... You could, in Oregon, have someone working 12 hours one day and 4 hours the next, and there'd be no entitlement to overtime unless you had a collective bargaining agreement or personnel rules to the contrary.
Correct.
Okay. And I want to close, April, by something that that you and I discussed just a bit offline. All of these developments with respect to the state and local laws, they impose huge challenges on employers, don't they?
Absolutely, especially when you have these brand new statutes and we don't really know what they mean or how they're going to be enforced. There are significant challenges for employers.
And for those of you who are listening on the union side of the table, I've seen it very often that unions actually learn about some of these laws before employers do and are the driving force behind employers changing their practices. Have you seen that occur as well?
I have seen that somewhat. I will say if I'm doing the bargaining, I usually know the law.
Knowing the law has always been discretionary for me. Yeah. Well, April, thank you so much for participating in this podcast. This has been a wealth of information. And for all of you out there, you have to understand, this is likely going on in your state. Maybe not if you're in Mississippi, but if you're in certainly on either coast or in the upper Midwest, and even in some very traditionally conservative states, you will see these changes on a city-by-city basis. So, for example, where Kentucky might not have, in fact, it doesn't have any laws that are analogous to most of the ones we've talked about here, in Louisville, there are, in fact, local ordinances that provide that. This is a minefield for employers, and April has just started describing the process of how to navigate that minefield. So just a caution to you, it's no longer enough to know just what your collective bargaining agreement says or just what federal law says. You have to be vigilant and you have to be updated on what the requirements are of the law in your area. Well, thank you for joining us for this premium edition of the LRAS podcast series. We hope to see you again next month. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.